Hello and welcome to Niaga Spotlight with me, Tamina Kausji. Niaga Spotlight goes through the week in business and future affairs, Market Watch, industries, analysis and insights. We've got you covered right here on Niaga Spotlight. Well, this week on future affairs, it's Niaga Spotlight forecasts for Malaysia's big data industry in 2024. Now, a brief overview before we begin. Malaysia is positioned to be a big data analytics or a BDA hub in the ASEAN region and Asia. This is, of course, in line with the government's targets for the industry. We've actually, in fact, emerged as a top destination in Southeast Asia for data center investment worth an impressive 76 billion ringgit between 2021 and March 2023 alone. Well, meanwhile, it's essential for Malaysia to address a significant challenge, deep talent shortages in this crucial industry. Niaga Spotlight forecast today will be looking at Malaysia's big data industry and also what's predicted to happen with AI, Gen AI, LLMs, BI, data science and data engineering in 2024. Sharla Axert, founder and CEO, Center of Applied Data Science, CADS, joins me now in the studios for this focused discussion. Good morning, Sharla. How are you today?
Morning, Tam. Really good. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic to have you in the hot seat, Sha. So let's begin by discussing Malaysia's incredible data center boom. Those figures are nothing to laugh at. Now, what do you think is actually perhaps some of the main factors behind such great regional as well as global interest for investing in data centers in Malaysia?
I think we are really blessed, right, with land and talent in this part of the country. And I think you would say, oh yeah, so is Indonesia, Philippines and Thailand have the land. But this shows that, you know, Malaysia has invested a lot on infrastructure to accommodate the digital economy that we'll be talking about. So if you look at Malaysia, data internet penetration is 80%. You know what's the global average? It's only 50%.
So that shows,
yeah,
great. A huge uptake. That's like what? At least 30%
exactly.
on average.
Exactly. And that shows great faith in Malaysia, right? And having said that, it is not self-evident for the talents. So we actually have to put a lot of work to make sure there's talent to support this investment. But having said that, this is an upgrade from manufacturing.
All right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That doesn't make us the Silicon Valley. So we are not an innovative hub. It's just an upgrade from manufacturing.
Right. So being at an upgrade from manufacturing itself, I think we're looking at the fact that we've got a lot of expansive land availability as well as power resources and a lot of global connectivity. So to build upon that a little bit, perhaps if you have any perspectives around how Johor has also become quite the hub, attracting potentially up to perhaps even 10 global tech players, once again, for BDA investments, but at the same time, maybe they're going to be attracting around 5 of them in total. Any perspectives around that?
I think any kind of investment on tech will allow us to become an innovative nation. And we talked about it earlier, right? The kind of talent we produce will determine what kind of investors we're going to get.
Right.
So this is, we are in part to that. But then again, what kind of investment that we are pulling in is going to determine whether we're going to be just an upgrade in manufacturing or we're going to be the innovation hub that we talked about.
Exactly. So when it comes to the fact that these global tech players that are going into Johor, they are actually many of those who already have a presence in Singapore. What are some of the similarities, in your opinion, that both Singapore and Malaysia have actually been playing off attracting this kind of data center investment? And also, any thoughts on what Singapore has been doing, which has helped them to go past that manufacturing and then that next step into the more knowledge-based sector?
I think one of the key things, Singapore from early on has adopted the AI strategy.
Right.
And we know that any country, any organization has this vision of what having this AI as the main strategy in the country and the organization will have
sure.
a leap forward than anybody else. And I think they got that right. And we are a little bit slow in catching up, but we are getting there. You know, I'm always about it's better to start than never, right? Everything in Singapore is expensive. Land is expensive, right? But they've always been clever in doing the talent retention. They always have a bucket list. They make sure they attract the best talent in this region. And what Malaysia has going for ourselves is, like I said, we have been blessed by the land and by the talent. mm-hmm. right? But Malaysia does have the biggest brain drain in ASEAN.
Yeah,
and there's a gap between the kind of skills we create and why talents leave the country.
Absolutely. And I'd love to really dig our teeth into that a little bit later, though. However, let's go back into looking at all the bulk of investments in excess of 76 billion ringgit. Now, do you feel that there ought to be a limit to how many, especially hyperscale data centers or HDCs, that we are able to accommodate comfortably? I don't mean via land capacity, because that is, of course, in comparison to some neighbors such as Singapore, it's pretty limitless in Malaysia. But let's look more at energy consumption, power and such like, which is also what led to Singapore having more recently the moratorium, right, on any more HDCs there.
I think that's really important. The government needs to keep an eye on that. You know, Sweden leads in a sustainable data center, and they have right. data center in the coldest and the remotest area in Sweden because of the energy that it consumes and it lets out, right? I like to give this story. When I was studying in university 25 years ago, and I mean,
right.
I don't know my age now, but, you know, golf course was a big boom in this part of the world, right? It was a huge industry,
sure.
tourism and stuff like that. Then suddenly we were hit by a shortage of water. And who had to pay the price for it? It was the rakyat, right? We had to conserve water for 2 days, you know, get the pails, the baldi, be it. And then these industries need to be accommodated. So if the government doesn't keep track of this, you know, when there's a demand, the need goes up and you cannot tax the rakyat anymore because energy is already heavily subsidized by
it already
government,
is,
right? And
clearly.
TNB is doing a great job in looking at the green part to support these data centers.
Correct, correct.
That, but it needs to be monitored. It needs to have a lookout. So we don't end up, you know, the rakyat don't end up fighting for the same energy source like we did for water.
Exactly. And I love the fact that you actually brought up the example of Sweden, because that reminds me as well, Shah, the fact that it is a challenge, in fact, to have any kind of a data center located within a tropical climate where it's already warm. But of course, you need to keep the temperature at optimal. So while it may be on one hand, perhaps a little bit damaging to the environment in a very cold country, what about in a very hot country?
Yes.
So when it comes to managing that, do you reckon there's a need for perhaps a central policy that regulates and maybe even oversees sustainability? We've been talking a lot about sustainability. COP28, of course, finished not so long ago. Malaysia, of course, has its zero target goals when it comes to environment as well as carbon, right?
Yeah. I think the stage we are, that needs to happen because we are in a developing country, right? In Sweden, there's this whole culture about trust base and doing the
okay.
right thing and about the environment. People mm-hmm. Look at living in peace with the environment and the person next door to you. So I think it took them 100 years to get there. You know what I mean? So when you are a high innovative nation where the system takes care of you, you pay a huge amount of tax and they have trust. It's a very trust-based culture, right? And it's easy for them to decide, we're going to go to the remotest place and we're going to do this huge data center where
right.
energy is an issue, right? And not bring down the whole climate.
So it's pretty strategic planning.
Yes, and for countries like us where, you know, it's an opportunity of investment, which means GDP, which means a greater opportunity for the rakyat, it needs to have some kind of framework, monitoring and baseline for this.
Absolutely. And I think this perhaps ought to be integrated with the wider national energy transition policy
yes.
and roadmap, right?
Yes, definitely.
Fantastic. Thank you for bringing that up. From there, Shah, let's move on into the fact that the pandemic, of course, was a game changer in terms of demand for BDA, big data analytics, backed by, you know, surging demand for data, cloud services. So what are some key areas or trends that you're able to discern will be popular in 2024?
So first of all, we saw the MDAC report with IDC about the growth, what, 1.1 billion to 1.9 billion. That's what BDA is supposed to.
Correct, by 2025.
Yeah, but it's not enough.
Incredible.
Not being ambitious enough.
Oh, really? Okay. All right.
So think about it, right?
Tell me.
So AI is here. It's exponential growth.
ChatGPT is a part
exactly.
of everyone's life.
It's, it's not linear growth. So a human, an individual with AI will surpass any individual without AI. So I think we are not ambitious enough in that. You know, so I think we are not embracing these changes that generative AI is doing. So if you're talking about key trends, I mean, AI, generative AI, cybersecurity, cloud computing, they're not trends anymore, right? They are they've been there for the longest, and the demand is always going to be there. What is going to be key in this future, 2024, it's going to be a skill economy.
Mm-hmm.
So what it's going to be is you going to democratize skills in organization, which will be a strategy. It will be skills first transformation. It will be making sure your workforce is data and AI literate.
Mm-hmm.
That means you're going to democratize skills that everybody will understand the use of data and AI, and no more centralized. You know, it's going to be beyond the data scientists of the world.
That's right. It's all about, you know, scaling it so that every single person within an organization is able to
understand.
Exactly. And understanding and practicing it as well is quite different, though. From there, let's talk about the fact that you've mentioned that we're not being ambitious enough. So perhaps let me just posit this to you. What about a cluster of partnerships going into this industry, which is basically, you know, government-linked companies or GLCs, perhaps? They have the financial capability, but then them forming partnerships with the private sector so that we can have more that is local Malaysian, but that is connected to the wider global infrastructure.
I love that. And I think that's something that we've been talking for years now, especially for entrepreneurs and high growth tech companies, right?
Yep.
You rightfully, GLCs, government linked companies are the highest employers in this country. And we're slightly different from the States. You know, they're the biggest employers, and they need to work with, if you want to get local players to go global, we need them to buy local.
Mm-hmm.
Right? To
literally.
Yes,
so that, yes.
Literally. So invest. We used to talk about belilah barangan buatan tempatan, right? Beli local fruits, right? And it's with this huge technology, and we want to get more tech companies from the country, this is perfect to do the private-public partnership and elevate them, because most of these companies are in Fortune 500, Fortune 1000. And you imagine, as you grow, you bring the local companies with the right caliber and tech, right? And it has to be meritocracy. It has to be the right technology that you help them, get that and validate them in the global market.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
So, of course, we are in 2024 now. Saying it and doing it is two different things, though. What kind of a structure do you think might help accelerate this kind of a vision for a lot more Malaysian-made big data analytics? Also considering and touching lightly upon the fact that we do have our data security issues.
So if you look at, you know, in the US and Europe, right, you have special location for female businesses,
right?
So we could do the same thing with local businesses, because the requirement for a lot of these companies to engage local businesses is literally global standards. And we all are trying to make it in a local market, right? So I think it's important to have that category. We could give, you know, tax incentive for companies to adopt more local practitioners. That could help companies to want to use local. And it's a shift in the mindset for these private organizations to start sourcing out, you know, tech companies internally. Singapore's already doing that for
that's
a
right.
while now, right? So that's a mind shift, that it doesn't always have to be a global player. It always, the standards is that if you want to get that, you need to invest in local players to get that. So we need to create exception with the right, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, security. It's very expensive for small companies
Absolutely.
To put in.
So
the
it does need to be a bigger infrastructure,
yes.
right?
So
everybody jumps on board.
Yes. So if they can, if big companies could subsidize getting small companies to work on security while they implement the system in the company, that would be so helpful for local tech companies.
Local tech companies, exactly. Lots to chew upon over there. So from the huge investments being made, Shana, of course, that brings up the opportunity for plenty of jobs. But at the same time, we've actually got a very deep talent shortage. One thing on the bright side, perhaps, is that this isn't unique to Malaysia alone. The technology industry in general is facing a huge global shortage of workers, anywhere from 3 to 4 million folks, yes, or PACs, yes, when it comes to Malaysia. You've also often spoken about your vision for, you know, of course, us moving more towards a high-income nation, especially via upskilling in time. So thoughts about how we can actually close that skills-talent gap, particularly with our fresh undergraduates and those who are still perhaps in university without doing something which is too uncomfortable, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it's not just enough for us to know what is the current skills that we have in the country or in the organization. I think it's important to know what we have today and how to get that individual into the skills that years to come.
Sure. Okay?
And that cannot be done manually. This is why I founded CATS, right? It's important to automate this process because it needs to be quick. Mm-hmm. 30% of the skills that we know has gone, right? It doesn't exist. But in 5 years' time, 65% that we have, skills that we have today, will not exist. So how do we keep up with that? And that's why, you know, I came back and it was important to build this platform, because every profession, mm-hmm, be it journalism,
sure,
legal,
sure,
finance, university graduates in whatever faculty, need to have AI and data skills as part of their portfolio, right? So you will have a chance to make a difference, automate things in the job you do, and it cannot be that IT guy that you're going to call upon to kind of change the work that you do.
Mm, absolutely. Now, what do you think about the fact that there's also a lack of education and training programs, particularly in the Malaysian higher education market, that specialize in data center technology? What would be top of your list if you were able to suggest what kind of programs need to be targeted towards our young people?
We have to stop. You know, this is very controversial for me to say this, right? We, in the whole world of data and, okay, AI, we should stop streaming, right? We should stop saying that only IT guys can do this job, only mathematicians can do modeling for engineering. We have had, in Astro, we had a Mandarin graduate who became a data scientist who takes care of your Mandarin channel. Right? So this is what the vision is, that we grew up with streamlining, you know, and then saying that if you got straight A's, you got to do that. But the skills is always about what you can apply in your job.
And what you
domain,
pick up.
Right? Yeah. So your domain is journalism. Mm-hmm. Imagine you are embedded with that skill and you can do a lot more in that than giving it to an IT guy who doesn't understand your domain.
Right. So let's say we've got a lot of hyper-specialization right now. For example, lots of the better faculties around Malaysia, they actually have plenty of engineering undergraduates. But do they have to, or how could they be streamed then into the big data analytics industry?
This aches me because, you know, I'm a telecommunication engineer, which the cost doesn't exist anymore. You know?
Fair. That's okay.
But that's the whole point. That we tend to create graduates with skills in 4 years' time they come out, industries that might not survive, mm-hmm, this whole disruption. Okay?
True.
So I think it's important to set them with the fundamentals, which is really important, like talk about data visualization, analytical thinking, and to be able to tell stories out of data. Mm. If you get that in every faculty, being doctor, medicine, being what I say, you know, non-technical field, social economy,
right?
This will just elevate people starting to use data, and then they will adopt innovation and technology seamlessly. Mm. So you don't have to force feed, oh, you got to use digital, you've got to apply,
sure,
technology.
Exactly. So even looking at the social sciences as an arena for that. Now, what about a lack of awareness amongst existing undergraduates and young people about these kind of opportunities in data centers?
Oh, definitely. I remember we started something called Data Star because I was so tired of people saying,
right,
Malaysian graduate, local graduates are unemployable. I come from a local university, right? And then we have the highest brain drain. So there's this gap between, you know, what we have and what we're losing. And I think it's important that people understand that. It's important to get graduates exposed. You know, I said that in Asia, if you're not an engineer, lawyer, or a doctor, you're an Asian F. Right? So
that's a good one.
Yeah, I had parents who would come with the kids asking, oh, what is this data science? Yeah, data engineering. My son studied actuaries. Right? So this mindset in parents, educating, being in the media, talking about it, there's this demand, this skills that doesn't feel in the traditional,
exactly,
right, has to change. That's how we're going to be innovative. What you study not necessarily guarantees you the job that you want.
And it doesn't have to be the same format that it was even 5 years ago, right?
Okay. They might not exist in the next
True. All right. Now that we're also on the point of looking at the future workforce, Shah, I have to ask you, also a strong advocate for women in the workforce, and particularly women in STEM, women in tech. Now, what could we do better to ensure that, of course, we are actually seeing the stats skew more towards female undergraduates and graduates than male? And this is something which is not not unusual for all developing as well as high-income countries. How can we make sure women who already make up a smaller proportion of STEM graduates then actually get to stay on in the STEM sectors that they choose, even BDA?
I get a lot of these talks that I need to get women to be in STEM. I think that's not the problem. Okay, if you look at STEM education, women are the highest in university, in science stream, in school. Okay, 70% of the university graduates you talked about, it's about 60. We still are the largest, you know, we study. Girls are good at studying, right? And then the issue becomes we don't stay in the workforce. So I used
Once we begin our families.
Yes. So then I've stopped telling women getting into STEM. I just tell them, please stay in the workforce. And I think that happens because, you know, women don't stay on because they don't see enough women out there having it all. It might look like people ask, I run a business, I've got two kids, how do I do it all? But there's sacrifices that we have to do, and you need to get support system. And I've acknowledged I don't have to be a superwoman. So what I tell women at workplace is, what we can do is go and mentor, and even if you're not asked by another female, I think that's paying forward. I think women need female mentors, and girls in school need role model. And they don't see enough of us out there going out and saying, it's okay to have a job and not be the super mom all the time.
I love the fact that you are actually talking about paying it forward and perhaps even seeking out women to mentor, even if they don't ask, right?
Women don't ask. Fair enough.
I will resonate with that. All right. So from there, Shah, we're actually going to continue on the discussion because we might actually be waiting for a live cross, which will go into the Prime Minister Dato Sri Anwar Ibrahim's speech, which has been happening or is expected to occur soon. Meanwhile, we continue the discussion with Sharala in the studio. So let's look at the features of big data, which also spawn issues relating to privacy, data profiling, lack of transparency, etc. What would a big data law, perhaps, to regulate various aspects of AI and even big data usage, what might that entail? Just to set the ground, early in 2024.
I'm not a big fan on setting up, you know,
more regulations.
Regulation because it curbs innovation, right? So I'm not a big fan. But having said that, right, putting a brake is not an option, right? Because if you put putting a brake means there will be countries that do not have brakes and they're far ahead with AI and innovation. But having said that, it's really important to put the brakes on important things. Like if you look at EU that just passed a law about facial recognition, monitoring people wherever they are, any time of the day. Now, that is definitely a part to a greater evil. That could go so wrong. And I think that's why it's important to educate people and understand, you know, responsible AI, ethical AI at every level.
Correct.
Right? And then companies need to think about the trade-offs. You know, if you have the full-blown AI and data that you could do, the outcome is amazing, but at what cost, right? So to be able to understand putting brakes on just major things that can cause greater evil needs to stop there. Is it worth the money that we get?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that kind of regulatory, like, you know, EU is a good place to look at. And I'm also, like I said, I'm not a big fan in putting a stop on innovation because all this stops innovation. But what is the greater good that we're trying to accomplish?
Sure. And speaking of the greater good we're trying to accomplish, one thing that I must intervene and ask you here. Now, with, of course, the rate of internet penetration in Malaysia, digitalization is absolutely a given, even for children who are under the age of, let's say, 5, right? So what kind of data privacy, etc., wider regulations would be ideal to help protect children online?
That's really important. I think my kids, right, and I remember like companies were looking at digital literacy and I go like, what digital literacy? My kids are born with digital literacy.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
They can do Canva and I'm still struggling with PowerPoint.
And toddlers know how to press on a smartphone.
Yes. You know, swipe.
And, that's right, you know. That's right.
But I think, you know, some schools have done it well and we try to do that at home. A few of my friends is all about, oh, we need to monitor what the kids are doing and we need to make sure that they shouldn't have phones. And we've gone the Swedish way. We've gone on a trust base, right? Because
right.
You cannot stop the kids doing what they want to do. But the only thing we could do is educate them, you know, and be there when things go wrong or to have the constant conversation. I think as Asian parents.
So digital literacy.
Yes. And we do not have that difficult conversation. Data, like I always share with my kids that what happens, why you're targeted, why you're getting this advertisement, because there's an algorithm out there that's constantly monitoring what you're doing.
Sure.
And no matter how much you try to avoid, somebody is going to win you over to buy something or to communicate with you, which is a bigger issue that we find with younger teenage
exactly.
kids, that who's talking to them, what are they saying to them.
Online grooming and all these kind of issues.
Exactly.
As well, right?
So the only way we're going to get away with this is to get to the core of it. Education, data and AI literacy.
Absolutely.
People understand that from work to home.
Absolutely. So I think the issue that is actually coming up here is clearly that it's not enough to have only internet penetration, internet accessibility, all this wider investments that we're seeing in the landscape for Malaysia. But at the same time, you need to have a population that is comfortable enough to take best advantage of what's online.
Yes. You change culture through tech. And we know that, right? You use tech. But if you acknowledge that, if I do Facebook selling, and I understand the data and not just Facebook selling, then I optimize the usage of tech. So you change the culture. And we cannot put a brake on this, right? We're talking about generative AI. Companies are trying to block it. People, this is an amazing technology. We need to figure out how to live with it instead of fight it.
Exactly. So from there, Shah, we move on into discussing what the industry predictions are for 2024, which of course state that AI is going to supercharge, but social engineering attacks on an unprecedented scale. So we're also going to be looking forward to plenty of red herring days, as we call them, in the global ecosystem, all the way from you've got the American general elections, you've got the Paris Olympics, the UEFA Euro 2024 tournament. So what are the risks involved in when it comes to social engineering during these kind of really grand global scale events where everyone, including of course Malaysians, are not just part of the audience but are part of everything that goes on around them, which is things like, you know, huge sales happening online, etc., to drive some of the traffic that is already captive towards that?
Yeah. You know, that's what is incredible about this technology and AI. And I'm a huge fan. By now, I can't be lying. I'm a huge fan of this advancement that it gives, right? But like all great things, right? You know, this is a race between evil and good, okay? Companies need
the duality
to be
of life.
Like, yes, criminals will always find ways to steal. And that's essentially all situation, right? So companies are at war. So what happens is you need to prepare. And I think I kind of liked it that Malaysia spent the last 3 months last year creating this awareness of data privacy and protection.
Correct,
you know?
Correct.
And I think more of that needs to be done. Organizations need to enable at the working level. It's no more top down, yeah? It's no more, you know, CEOs have been there for the longest and they struggle with this new change. And centralizing this kind of information is not enough. So when you decentralize and you allow people who have the domain expert to be able to counter, so you can actually prevent things then, you know, you do intervention, you know, you react to things. And you have people with domain expert, nimble and agile to be able to fight this.
So domain experts, once again, that's going back into needing specialists in-house, perhaps, especially for bigger organizations.
Yes.
Yep. So we've seen a lot of bank scams, for example, or financial scams, even drop scams that Malaysians have unfortunately fallen prey to. And this actually goes cuts across age demographics, which is quite interesting. You have those perhaps on the younger side, employment side, meaning anyone between 20 to 50 falling prey to drop scams. Then you also have the financial scams. Plenty of our elderly, unfortunately, have even been swindled completely out of their savings. So what can organizations, particularly in the financial sector, maybe Dusha, to be able to then look back and then use AI in turn to be able to help improve the defenses that we have?
So what, we ranked what, fifth or eighth in the world,
eighth, actually,
right?
Yes, exactly. For breachability.
Yes, and I read the report, what?
Not a list you want to be on.
I know, right? So the biggest breach is the government data, and then
that's
telco
correct.
Is the leak that we have, hence all these phone calls that we're getting. You know, and financial sectors have been really advanced to look at fraudulence activities, and they've been really good at trying to be more proactive. But end of the day, it's educating the people not to fall for this.
Exactly.
Right? So we can put every mechanism, like I say, criminals always find ways to steal.
Sure. And we should anticipate that as a given.
Yes. Yeah. And I think we should be more transparent in communicating if there's a breach that happened. I mean, if it's happened, it's
and
happened.
And have an SOP, right?
Yes.
Have you seen, for example, in all the various data breaches we've seen, let's just look at the previous calendar year. Was there anyone that stood out to you for having a good SOP that yourself as an expert would, you know, approve of?
Not really. I think there's people
Ouch.
Still
but
react.
Okay.
That's the thing. Prevention, you know, we react to things that we didn't anticipate. Although we know that's going to happen, when it happens, we are all surprised, right? And I do know one bank came close in setting up call centers to be able to. And then again,
I remember that.
Yeah, but when they call you, you're thinking it's spam, right? It's phishing.
Of course.
I don't take calls from 03, even if it's from a local bank, right?
True.
So that kind of hurts a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But having put out there and acknowledging that you've been, this has been happening, allows customers to call you back to check if their account is safe.
Mm.
And to have that, it's painful, right? We all have this Asian thing that we want to hide, you know, under the earth and hope that it goes away. And, and it doesn't.
And it doesn't, absolutely. Yes. So on that note, though, we take a quick break. We'll be back right after with the rest of the interview with Sharla Axer. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Niaga Spotlight. Still with me, Tamina Kausji. And today, of course, we are on a forecast episode looking at Malaysia's big data industry in 2024. And I'm, of course, continuing the conversation with Sharla Axer in the studios. So, Shah, going a little bit deeper into the fact that we're going to see a lot of AI supercharging the social engineering in Malaysia, especially. So we're going to be seeing some spikes around key dates. Now, Malaysians, we love to shop. And of course, there are always not just annual sales, but sales that happen around festive seasons, of which we've got plenty as well. We're just done with New Year. We're looking forward to Chinese New Year. And of course, after that, Ramadan and Hari Raya. So what are some...
planning your shopping trips?
Oh, I think I might be here. but to come into it with a big data point, how can people actually, while we're going about our business online in that sense, also stay on the lookout for what might actually be data breaches or even some little red flags that may go unnoticed for the average online shopper?
I think it's improved tremendously. We were just talking about it, like I can't use my Touch and Go without validating 100 times about my ID or my passport, right?
Or the figure, or the amount.
Yeah, so I feel we've taken it to the next level, that it's not so easy now to go in and just use up your credit to buy something. You know, it has to go to the bank and you wait SMS and before you do it. And I think as inconvenient as it is now, I think that's a huge, huge take up on how important this is to have, security in the money that you're going to spend.
Sure.
And I think the older e-commerce, the more mature e-commerce has put in a lot of, you know, the Lazadas and the Shopees that you can even insure your delivery, right? Because you, the whole point we go into this trusted platform is you trust that they would validate the sellers, okay? And then you have some popular ones that you don't know the sellers who come into the platform for different reasons.
Fair.
And you need to know those kind of, what do you call, sellers out there, what kind of platform you go into. I think the red flags that we tend to look at is, I think more so not about the money that you spend, it's about the quality of things that you get on that. Buying medication over...
Fair enough. Yeah, verifying that these are actually legitimate.
Yes, and a lot of us go like, oh, it's cheaper than me going to the pharmacy. But, you know, we the trust on internet has gone, you know, journalism, trust in journalism, you do check, you do fact checks.
And anything, check, yes.
I'm a big fan of journalism ever since, you know, AI and generative AI comes. There's nobody to validate this. I think those are the things that, you know, you need to watch out. Kids using this online purchasing is a big thing. Like my daughter keeps asking, why can't I have my own account? And I'm going like, no, you tell me, I buy.
Right.
And it used to be with iPhones, right? Where kids, you put your credit card and kids will be using your phone. And before you know it, your bill for the games have gone thousands of ringgit. But which now all these matured platform have put in
safeguards
in it, you know. Fair. But chatting with people, asking to give information, I think that has to be a big no-no. And we know that Malaysia is high on that. People making calls, oh, you want the lottery, emails.
Correct.
You know, and
I think we all know someone, you know, maybe even 1 degree separated who's been a victim of such scams.
Yes, and we need to talk about it. You know, it's nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah, don't stop talking about it. Right. So still talking about it, though, let's dive into Malaysia's cybersecurity gaps, Shah. What do you think can be done immediately as we're fast accelerating towards not just 2025, but also 2030, whereby which, of course, the transaction volume, etc., all of that is just going to exponentially increase? What does Malaysia need to do to be able to keep up? Ensure, hopefully, we're not going to have quite as many data breaches. We've, of course, just had the launch of PADU, the government database, integrating all of that.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a controversial conversation when I talk about going cloud or having server in premises, right? A lot of these organizations feel safer in having their servers in their premises. And I think that would be one of the major reasons for, you know, security breach. Because the way cloud works, and we have this PDPA where you cannot put, you know, personal data outside the country, and all that is important. But the way the cloud works is, it basically my name would be in server in Canada, my address would be in a server in India and another, you know, so it's so segregated as one individual information that makes it harder, right, to just hack and get all the information you need. And that becomes an issue with a lot of banks not wanting to go cloud because of the uncertainty of the technology and rather have something in the back door that you know you can look at it and watch it.
Right.
I think that's not helping. And I think people need to embrace technology, go cloud. Cybersecurity talent is a big issue in this part of the world, so we get a lot of foreigners to do that, and I think that that's important to nurture that. Having said that, cybersecurity law, right? We don't have enough legal firms out here that specializes in that, and I think all that needs to, we need to create an ecosystem, a healthy ecosystem that helps, you know, monitor. And I hate when I say things like we are always reacting. Right, we need to start putting. We like do first, then you know we figure it out.
Sure. But or it thing, happens, the snafu is done, and then we reflect.
And then we're on the other side where we are too cautious, too careful to do this. And oh, you know, I think our central bank says you can do whatever with the data, provided that if there's a breach, you're answerable. Then people are like, you know, that's how innovation works, right? Like, oh, I'm not going to touch this because this is people's data, and I'm
that's
gonna,
right. Yeah, exactly. So to end the conversation, Shah, what would be top of your wish list when it comes to big data analytics and the entire big data industry for 2024 in Malaysia?
So we forget in this whole technology, human are the center of this. We are the maestro, you know, we are the conductor of the orchestra, right? You know, if you think about flying a plane, you don't put it in autopilot without a pilot. You don't do a pilot without a co-pilot. Fair, so if something goes wrong, you know, the person, the most experienced person in the cockpit is the one who's going to decide whether the, or help us from, you know, saving the plane and lives, right? So I think we have to understand the human factor is the one that is going to mend this, who's going to make it better than evil. And we should embrace it because I think this is going to change the way we live. It's going to change the education of our kids.
Sure.
It's going to change the business we're in. And it's going to make it, you know, better and efficient. So if we are the center of it, we need to own it.
Mm-hmm. And take charge now.
Take charge. So it's not about policing. We love policies and policing. And it's not about regulatory. It's all about, you know, being the center of the whole technology is the human that we should not forget.
Exactly. And of course, not forgetting the fact that, yes, 76 billion ringgit in investments, but let's make sure at least 50% of the economic opportunities that stem from that actually go into the Malaysian workforce, right?
Yes. Yes. It's my vision for the country is to become the innovative hub. When you prepare the talent to create and innovate, then we are better than just doing manufacturing jobs.
There you go. Sherala, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us here.
Thank you, Tam.
Well, that's all we have time for today on Niaga Spotlight. I'm Tamina Kausji signing off. Of course, join us next Friday for more business analysis and insights. Here's to a productive week ahead.